we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world.
Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense podcast. Now, some of you may be a little bit more observant, might understand or wonder why I've got some things in the background that are not normally here. And I'm coming from the Exeter Chiefs rugby ground in Exeter, where I've just finished 2 days at the Philosophical Breakfast Club, delivering something about interactions and relationships. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're a relationship with Chris, known him for a little while. And we're going to talk about a first story and a second story. And what I really ask is, if you like these podcasts, like these stories, like and share them, because that helps get that stuff out there. Everybody's got a podcast, but this one's really important. So, Chris, great to see you. For those who don't know who you are, can you explain people, you know, your background, where you've got to, where people can find you in the real world, and also in the online space? And we'll put your website and your email in the show notes.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks very much indeed for having me on the podcast, Gareth. As you said, my name is Chris Davies, and I'm the co-founder and co-director of a company called Volaria Performance. That's V-O-L-A-R-I-A, not the most common words. We deliver training in aspects such as human factors, human performance, crew and team resource management, and a range of non-technical skills along those lines, primarily, though not exclusively, to organizations in industries with a significant element of risk. So we're talking there aviation, perhaps, the medical world, clinical world, energy sector, et cetera, et cetera. So that kind of thing. From the perspective of how I got to where I am today, by far the majority of my lifetime has been spent in aviation. I was in the UK military for 25 years, primarily the Army Air Corps, in which I had the privilege of flying what was then Her Majesty's helicopters. I spent the last 10 years of that career both flying and delivering training on the Apache helicopter, in roles both as a squadron boss and as a training deliverer, weapons instructor, which was, I suppose, it was a potent mix of being rewarding. It was exhilarating, no doubt, and on occasion on operations, of course, pretty challenging at times. I left the military in 2012, and like many people who leave the military, I spent bit of a while figuring out exactly what I did want to do. I knew what I didn't want to do, wasn't sure what I did want to do. And then about 9 years ago, I made a very conscious decision that I wanted to move into this new burgeoning world of uncrewed aviation, drones to most people. And at around that same time, I also looked to expand upon the human factors and the crew resource management qualifications I'd always had as an aviator, but to look more closely at how those same qualities and the behavioral tendencies and so on translated across into other industries. And so I've spent pretty much all of the last 9 years or so in a variety of aviation, primarily uncrewed roles, but whilst also working with a range of organizations, helping them to develop their skills in these non-technical skills domains, such as human performance, teamwork, leadership, etc. And then finally, to bring this totally up to date, about 18 months ago, I re-established an old acquaintance with a good friend and former colleague, who you, of course, know as well, Grant Meakey, who's got extensive experience in the human performance sphere. And together, we joined forces and decided it was time to create Volaria Performance. From the perspective of contacting us, you can find me and Grant, and of course Valario Performance, either on LinkedIn, though I do confess with a name like Chris Davies, it can be a bit of a search, pretty common name. So you can find us on LinkedIn or via our website, which is valaria-performance.com.
Excellent. And it's really interesting that the bit about uncrewed systems and the human factors elements within there, because, you know, it's uncrewed. Yeah, but somebody still needs to operate it. And you've, you know, these more complicated uncrewed systems, RPAS, remote pilotly led systems, they're not simple little drones. They're complicated, complex capabilities that often have more than one person operating to operate the platform, but also they sit in a wider network of what's going on. They don't operate individually. So it's really interesting to hear that that's coming into there. And I would say it's probably a burgeoning market given where things are. So thank you for sharing that background. So, you know, those who listen to this podcast understand the normal framework is that we tell a first story, which explains something in pretty simple terms. So what is the first story that you've got, Chris?
Okay, I'm going to take it to a slightly, almost a double level compared to some of the stories on your podcast, in that there is the how it made sense bit is actually on a second level. There's an initial stage, which is the event itself, but actually I want to look at the reaction to that initial phase, because the initial phase is effectively an understandable error in that it's linked to a skill-based task. It was the response that actually left all the few of us eyes wide open, thinking, what was that person thinking?
Go for it.
Yeah. Thank you. The story takes place, it was in an operational theater a number of years ago. So we're talking back when I was in the military. And at that stage, I was in an organization that was flying a helicopter called the Lynx. Well, I'm sure you'll be familiar with it. It was a relatively small, relatively lightweight aircraft, did carry a number of passengers on board, but it was the slick formation. So it, by rotary terms, by helicopter terms, it was fairly fast and agile. And in this theater where we were operating, as with most theaters, there was quite a significant threat to helicopters in terms of small arms fire and surface-to-air missiles. So it's a threat you have to take seriously. And in such theaters, operationally, you have a thing called a threat band, which is from about 150 feet above ground level up to about 2,000 feet, in which you're at greatest risk from these various threats, small arms and missiles. So needless to say, you need to expedite getting through that band, both on the way up and on the way down. And for the way down, a maneuver that would be employed is a thing called a rapid descent. And what you would do, you would fly along just above the 2,000 feet mark, and then you'd bring your speed back, you'd wash all your speed up. And then, I'll be honest, it was quite fun. You'd point your nose at the floor. So point the nose down, the speed would build up very quickly, and you would shoot through this band at quite a speed. At the bottom end, you would then level out, and that vertical speed would get turned into horizontal speed. And so there you were, just above ground level, whipping along, having got through your threat band. Now, there was a risk associated with this, which is at the bottom end there, as you are washing that vertical speed off and turning it into horizontal, the rotor head, the blades, behave like a sycamore. They speed up. They get the upward movement of the air causes them to speed up. And unless the pilot's on top of that and controlling it with collective lever, then the head can actually go faster than it's designed to. That it's called an overspeed. You're overspeeding the head. And what that means is if you have an overspeed, which you'll pick up by reading the instruments, that's it. The aircraft is effectively unserviceable now. You should return to base, you should shut down, and the aircraft has to go through a series of inspections to see to what extent, if any, it's been damaged. So that's sort of the initial stage. We're talking a high-energy maneuver at low level with a threat, people on board, varying conditions of weight and wind and so on. So the skill required, there's no doubt about it. It was a difficult maneuver, but errors may well occur. So moving on to the bit that's the nonsensical bit, perhaps. There had been a series of these overspeeds taking place. And the commander of the organization at the time let it be known that the crews henceforth who had an overspeed would be fined £400. Now, that's quite a bit of money these days, frankly, but back then that was a considerable amount of money. So I'll ask you, Gareth, did you think it had its desired effect?
Absolutely not. So immediately I can imagine what happens is that stuff gets hidden, and you will likely end up with a bunch of overspeeds, which people don't talk about, which then puts a threat. I don't mean it in the sort of harm threat, but you've got a system threat that's now hidden. It's a latent problem. And if that goes on enough, you have no idea what mechanical, technical damage is being done until somebody who operates the aircraft inside the envelope, but because the aircraft is no longer mechanically inside the envelope, the system can fail catastrophically.
Nailed it. Absolutely nailed it.
I didn't know about that, but I know human performance and I know human factors and how and why systems behave the way they do.
Absolutely so. Unfortunately, it didn't end up with a catastrophic bit, but it certainly, the reported overspeeds went to zero.
Yeah, yeah.
No more were reported. But as you absolutely pointed out, they were still taking place. Completely they were. Because it was a skill base, it was a difficult maneuver, it was skill base, humans make errors, so it was happening. Yeah. And as you say, it just introduced that latent threat. Now, the whole bit, the fine bit, to some, and I'd probably suggest with a more traditional approach to responding to negative outcomes, they might apply the standard counterfactuals that we know about, the woulda, coulda, shoulda, and declare the person at fault. So they might see that as a good idea. I suspect for the majority of people who are listening to this podcast, there's a very good chance that they'll be sat there thinking, how on earth did that make sense? I mean, what was that person thinking? Of course, a fine is punitive. It suggests agency on the part of the person who made the error. It suggests they made a choice rather than error. And it totally ignores the conditions. And of course, on your podcast a while ago, Jesse Singer was talking about those conditions. It echoes what she was talking about for the cycle lane in New York. And it completely ignores all those elements of the initial training of the maneuver, subsequent opportunities for training. You're in an operational theater. There's not many of those. There are lives on the line now, so pressure's building. You've got the threat on the ground and, frankly, the threat of crashing. And to be honest,
so just from a listener's point of view, I'm just thinking about, you know, people might want to have some sort of numbers and the sort of window that we're talking about. So you're basically at 2,000 feet, you pull the speed back, you're going to convert that from horizontal to vertical. So what's the rate of descent? What I'm going to say is, you know, what's the sort of roughly the time windows we're talking about? So to be able to round out at, say, 100 feet above ground, what's the decision point above 150 feet? You know, giving people an idea of what's the window where you have to, you know, sort of Luke Skywalker sticking a target down the shaft. And you sit there and go, right, I've got a fraction of a second to get this right. What sort of time period are we talking about?
I would suggest, funnily enough, never timed it, but I would imagine we're talking, going through the threat band is probably a period of around 20 to 30 seconds from top to bottom. By the time you get to the bottom end, for a start on the way down, you're having to monitor your airspeed. So, but equally, your eyes, as the person with hands on the controls, your eyes have to be out on stalls. They have to be, because you can't afford to base this maneuver on looking in and figuring out your height from dials. It has to be looking at the ground. And you're getting the green rush, of course, coming towards you.
And the terrain that you're over, you're going to be using visual cues to determine distance. And this reminds me of a crash in Norway of aircraft going up a valley and using the size of the trees as a metric of distance above ground. And the problem was the trees got smaller as they went up the valley. And as a consequence, they got closer to the ground and smashed into the valley wall. So I can see that what you're descending over is also going to impact your acuity of how far you are off the ground and the roundout start of the roundout maneuver.
Absolutely so. Yeah, very, very much so. And as you say, the surface itself, if it's a plain surface, and yeah, we apply this method in a variety of operational theatres, that could include ones that a desert scenario, for example.
And at night on night vision goggles as well?
And at night also as well, yes. So, I have found myself in a situation where, as a relatively junior pilot, where I'm very glad to say a marvellous Royal Marine who was flying with me did an excellent job of choosing to encourage me to round out, shall we say. It's a manoeuvre that really, we're talking fine margins. And to add to that, you've got, there is no doubt about it, there's a degree of ego in there as well, which is between crews. You don't want to be that person who's entering sheepishly or rounding out early, etc. So there's a degree of that in there as well. All those together then bring about this risk of, at the bottom end, if things are going to go wrong, there is no doubt about it, you're going to pull back on the cyclic, which is going to likely induce an overspeed. Frankly, rather an overspeed than piling into the ground, especially with passengers on board, of course. So that's the first story element. That is the setup. These errors were occurring. Fines were imposed. That's it. We now find ourselves in a situation where we're getting unserviceable aircraft that are still showing up in the fleet, ostensibly as serviceable. And we don't know how bad that is, a latent threat. I guess the kind of messy second bit of it, that this more complex bit, I would suggest that it's in most of us, especially those of us who consider ourselves slightly more enlightened in terms of considering the local rationality of the frontline worker, that we still find ourselves in a situation where it's quite easy to blame upwards. These leaders are idiots. This kind of response is just, it's the work of a fool. What are they thinking? But I think by doing that, we're sort of falling into a degree of fundamental attribution error, into that trap, because we're recognizing the local rationality of the worker, those who are performing the task, but we're not applying the same standard to the leader who imposes the fine. We're just declaring leaders and managers as idiots. And so I suppose my thoughts on this would be to encourage the digging into the second story of the leadership approach to these negative outcomes as well. And to try and appreciate the factors influencing their decisions that may appear dumb, but which are undoubtedly down to all the pressures they're facing. So in that scenario, we're talking about a commander who needs to ensure there are serviceable aircraft available to perform the task. That commander is coming under pressure from above to deliver an operational capability. That means aircraft and crews serviceable, ready to go to deliver capability. And that will be a considerable pressure on operations. Mm. Also, at that time, we're stepping back probably now, 20 years, I would suggest. That stage, undoubtedly in the military aviation, I would say, there were cultural aspects at play here. And in the period building up to that, which was, generally speaking, humans are the cause of issues in otherwise robust systems, rather than being the glue that holds that system together. That trotting out that percentage, how often are human factors a cause? 70 to 90% the human involved. So humans are the cause of the issue. Secondly, a fairly traditionally binary approach, which is either you're looking at a technical problem, and if it's not technical, then it's the person.
Must be human. Yeah.
Must be. And although we look closely, if it's a technical area, we look really closely at it. What went wrong with the material? How often had it been stressed, et cetera, et cetera? We didn't tend to provide that same level of scrutiny when it was considered that it was a human error. And also culturally at the time, I think there was a genuine belief that the stick rather than the carrot was a perfectly valid component of training methods. And of course, the very nature of the way training works, often the stick would produce an immediate response, but it's not actually, as it turns out, because of the stick. It's because standard deviation away from a genuine trend upwards. But all those things together would give this impression of, let's deal with the person.
I think my experience at that time, because I was in a research role at that time, coming from a military aircrew sort of, not aviation, sort of aircraft environment, the RAF, the way that fatigue was managed as well was a very different way to how the Army managed aircrew fatigue. And I remember getting a situation report in the organization I was in at that time, which came through from headquarters, from an operational field. And the sort of report was, these guys are really knackered. They're really tired. We are going to have an accident at some point soon. We need to adopt what the helicopter force, the RAF, are doing in terms of flight hours and crew rest and crew duty time. And it's like, whoa, that's different. Don't normally see that. Following week, DITREC came through. We don't have an issue with fatigue. It's all fine. And it was just this bit of, you can imagine what's happened in the operational theater. The boss, the chain of command, has read this sit rep and gone, that's not how we do things around here. All the aviation assets, simplistically, are just 4-ton of trucks with wings on them. What's the problem? And so, again, understanding their local rationality of, you can't just stop the aircraft and get out like you can with a truck. You know, things happen much more quickly in that space. And I'm guessing that the sort of the education of those in senior positions didn't really include crew resource management, flight supervisor, flight authorizer education to understand the limitations and the threats within the system.
Yeah, that's true. It was certainly at nascent stages. It had by then been introduced, but there's a difference, of course, between having the learning put in front of you and A, understanding it, and B, applying it. And from an application perspective, you're absolutely right. There would be, in an operational environment, well, those people who we need to get from A to B, they're working at all hours and short naps, et cetera, to get done, and the operation imperative and all the rest of it. And so we'll do the same. And I mean, I won't deny, I've on one particular operation, shall we say, I got up on the Thursday morning and was in an operational flying role before I went to bed next on the Saturday night. Throughout that entire period, we were operating. And I have fallen asleep at the controls in flight before in such an environment. Because, as you say, it was seen as you, the individual, are in control. If you want to deal with fatigue, have another cuppa.
That bit, falling asleep on my feet in a strip in an operational theater, you know, waiting for our landing zone to clear at, you know, low circadian rhythms of 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And it was just like, and couldn't even pull the seat out because of the armor that was on it. So at least we had four people on the flight deck. And there are numerous examples of people falling asleep because of the operational tempo. And this becomes an internal conflict within the operators. We have to support these people. We have, you know, we are a, for want of a better term, a service capability for the troops on the ground or the guys at sea, moving people from A to B to achieve a goal. And we don't want to let those people down because the operations don't stop. And that then becomes the system resource problem of, do we have enough? Yeah, we have. We've got enough on, you know, chalked up. We can do that. But as you said, are they an operational capability that can be fielded, or are they a bunch of aircraft that are there that says, hey, we've got them on the line and they're available? It's like, really? Are they?
Yeah, exactly that. And I think there will undoubtedly be a tendency here to look at it and go, well, that's from a time ago. That's from 20 years ago. That's how things were then. we don't do that anymore, and we wouldn't respond in that way. But that's therefore to suggest that these days in organizations, we don't find ourselves with conditions such as operating pressures, such as systemic drivers that require a focus on the human rather than organizational conditions, that there isn't this desire for a leader to appear in control rather than admit potentially systemic or management vulnerabilities or failings. I mean, we don't see those anymore, right?
Well, I'm at a medical heavy conference called the Philosophical Breakfast Club. And just hearing some of the stories from the medical professionals in here and anybody who's involved in the UK and has had to deal with the National Health Service, knowing that it is just creaking and bursting at the seams and the inability to deal with things. And again, that's a much higher system. That's a societal problem of, can we declare to the public that actually we don't have a capability? That we've got to either raise the money somehow or better, you know, manage these things, better manage these things. Well, actually, it's managed as best as we can. We just don't have enough resource to do this, which means that you either have to have a risk to life, or we have to accept that we don't have a health service, or we have a big increase in taxes to manage those. And hearing some of the stories. And we've been really lucky here. We had a very powerful story on day one from a medical professional talk about a really difficult situation. And blaming up came as one of the topics that we came. And I said, we've got to look differently, because those in the executive team, it made sense for them to do what they did. What are their goals? What are their targets? What are they being rewarded for? How much genuine leadership training have they had? Not management training, a management resource, but leading people and listening to people and having compassion. And then today we had an executive director from another trust who started their sort of conversation. They weren't here yesterday, were here today. And they said, I feel very uncomfortable here. And this was him demonstrating vulnerability. I am one of those executive directors, and it is not easy. And we have to balance X and Y. And we've got to make difficult choices. And it's not to say they're right or wrong. It's just they are. And we all sort of went, that's a really powerful piece. And we need to have more senior leaders who are in that situation who can tell their story. So, you know, one of the things that I raised this morning is we need to get all the stakeholders in to tell their narrative. What are the drivers at the operational command level? What are the drivers at the aircrew level? What are the drivers at the engineering level? You know, do they have enough resources, people, equipment, and make sure that the aircraft are serviceable? Because each one of those contributes or detracts from the safety of the system that's going on.
Yes, yeah, exactly that. And I think that is the vital component, in that if we throughout an organization are in a position that we can have this empathetic view upwards as well as downwards, if there's a broad understanding of the issues faced at all levels of the organization, then I think it does free people up more to feel in a position where they want to offer help upwards as well as downwards. I think it represents a better understanding of how organizations can achieve this team approach. Which I know is a buzz phrase in itself, but if there is this empathy and understanding at all levels, then you're inevitably going to be in a position where people can do their piece in trying to address the pressures that are coming down onto the organization and are traditionally absorbed at that leadership level, which is where these pressures can build and you see reactions such as the one I've described. But equally other decisions that at first just seem crazy to those who are on the receiving end.
One of the bits that came out from these last couple of days as well is that there are a number of professionals from different departments within this NHS system. And they went, we didn't know anything about this. And so there's also that bit, and I made reference to Diane Bourne's launch decision of organizational secrecy, so that when things happen inside a silo, the other silos don't know that these things are happening. And so they're potentially operating independently, but adding risk in the same way that Scott Snook talked about practical drift, that everybody's using up a little bit of the elements. And so it's also that bit of, we have empathy and up and down, but we also have to have sharing inter and intra system, so domain. So it might be that you've got departments, different departments within an organization understand that, hey, they're struggling, and this is the conceptual problem they're struggling with. Do we have that same bit, or can we take some of their capability? And then intra system, intra domain is, what can rail learn from healthcare? What can healthcare learn from aviation? What can nuclear run from healthcare? What can software learn from shipping and maritime? Because fundamentally, and it's one of the, you know, why we've got a diversity of guests in this podcast, is fundamentally people are people. It's just the stories that change, that broadly we behave the same way when under pressure, when we've got those error-producing conditions. We, yes, there's going to be outliers, but generally, this is what happens, as opposed to, that's aviation. We don't have that problem.
It's so true. And I will do that bit of embarrassing you, because we first got to know each other because of your book, because of Under Pressure. And I'd read that as somebody who'd been working within the human performance, human factors side of things for some time. And it really helped me to broaden my understanding of that, of exactly that aspect, that this really is, does apply. It doesn't matter what technical, risk-related, complex system you're operating. It still has that human element in it, in which a human will make an error. It will have an outcome, and the way that outcome is dealt with, and the severity of the outcome, all has a part to play in understanding what we can do to prevent that. And as you know, I'm always ready to recommend your book to others outside within aviation, outside of the diving sphere, for exactly that reason. And I think going back to the event I referred to, it the ability to carry forward the lessons from that one really set me up, because although at the time we effectively nothing was learned, the crews learned to cover up their errors. Gone was the chat in the crew room of had an overspeed. Why did that happen? Because of this, and I did this, and I wasn't looking there, and great. So that was gone. But what it did do, I think it taught us, those of us who were under this command went away with a very clear understanding of the dangers associated with a punitive response. That's undoubtedly stuck. But also, I think a clear understanding as to, it's Todd Conklin and Sidney Decker's mantra, isn't it? You can blame and punish, or you can learn, improve. You can't do both. And so that, to me, really did stuck and stick throughout my career. And I suppose the final thing I took away was this aspect we've just spoken of, which was, don't assume the leaders are incompetent, because I did at the time. I undoubtedly thought, what on earth are you thinking? This is clearly nonsense. But with time, being able to come round to the view of thinking in terms of the pressures that individual's facing and how therefore we can work to ameliorate those pressures was definitely a lesson.
Totally. And it's that whole piece that the absence of an accident doesn't mean you've got a safe system. And you know, we count unsafeties. We don't count safety, because safety is there. And I recently had one of an old blog came through as a podcast of, safety is when nothing goes wrong. And when nothing goes wrong, there's no emotion attached with it. And because there's no emotion attached with it, it's really difficult to create some level of change. And that's the frustration, is when something does go wrong, the outcome bias, the severity bias kicks in, the emotional piece ramps up. And so we sit there and go, this is a terrible situation. We have to do something. And I'm minded of, I think it was Tuesday this week, Skybree posted the initial report into the Potomac crash between the regional jet and the Black Hawk. And there were two powerful bits that came out of that to me. One was everybody was focusing on the height of the corridor, the vertical extent, and whether or not the Black Hawk was in excess of that. So they were too high. But what nobody really considered, and it wasn't put on any of the charts, was the lateral extent of that corridor. So you could be at the full extent of the corridor, or where it basically touched the land, and you would only be less than 50 feet below an aircraft on the approach path coming in. So that was one bit that came in. And the number of close calls they'd had over the previous 18 months, 2 years, and nothing had gone wrong. And therefore, the belief is that the system was safe. And the final piece was where they basically turned around and said, we are not going to look at a procedural problem. We're going to shut the lane down because we're not going to shift it to an air traffic management problem, because air traffic are already busy enough managing other things. So what was, you know, the tragic events bring the spotlight to bear to stuff that's already in place, that humans are solving those problems dynamically, and we have no idea how close those margins are, and yet we've got a safe system. And just moving that problem to somebody else, hey, we'll move it to an air traffic confliction, deconfliction problem, that's not going to change anything. And we're going to discount that straight away.
Yes. And it is an area of concern. You'll be aware of this. I should stress that Volare Performance does particularly specialize in the human factors elements and crew resource management elements within the uncrewed world because of our backgrounds. And it's an area that really does concern me with the fact that it is such a burgeoning industry. The number of uncrewed vehicles we're seeing in our skies is increasing rapidly and is only going to get greater. And because we are prone to applying this outcome bias, that so far, touching wood, there hasn't been that major incident, we are continuing to surge ahead. I would suggest without necessarily a full understanding of the human elements of that very complex system. And we have identified ourselves this series of human factors components that are particularly relevant to uncrewed teams that actually are new. They're not things that we experienced before in aviation. Because aviation traditionally is a constrained location. It's in a cockpit. It might be talking to the extent of a whole aircraft. But of course, in crewed, you're talking serious geographical dislocation of individuals from each other. So you've got you've got issues with communication. You've got distributed information. You've also now dislocated yourself from the aircraft itself with all the elements that come with that. With the fact that you won't have the same risk outlook because you now as an individual aren't the one at risk. And all those components which are new, I am concerned that we're not where we need to be yet in our understanding of that broadly as an industry.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
And it concerns me greatly that we will see a significant event and we will look back on ourselves and go, we didn't really do what we could have done. Hence why, obviously,
that's good.
Push it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for this brilliant sort of exploration of some of the side of aviation, which is, you know, my sort of background. It's where a lot of the human factors in dynamic spaces is operating. You know, we've got human factors in the nuclear area, then aviation became this bit. And it took a significant number of sentinel events to trigger bringing crew resource management, non-technical skills, and then growing that into threat and error management, and then moving into other domains. And the fact that we are human, we all behave that same way, and it's understanding the conditions. So the final piece of the podcast is a book, a paper, a video, or multiple versions of those that you'd recommend for people to grow and learn accordingly.
Okay, I won't be completely crass and mention your book again. So I'm a huge fan of audiobooks, and I tend to seek out those that are going to give me a new perspective on something I think I already know. I really enjoy those. And so I'd recommend a couple. I've mentioned already we work quite regularly in high-risk industries, and we tend to believe we have an understanding on what the response to a very significant event looks like. But I'd recommend When the Dust Settles by Lucy Easthope. And it's a really I won't spoil it too much by giving too much away about exactly what it's about, but it's a really fascinating insight into the aspect of post-disaster operations about which we rarely think. We tend to focus on the rescue stage, but then the cameras and the world's media disappear and the recovery begins. And this is where the book focuses. It's on that recovery afterwards. It's touching and it's thoroughly enlightening and really will give a totally different perspective on large-scale disasters, unfortunately. And the other one, to lighten things up a bit, is Alchemy by Rory Sutherland, that legend in the world of advertising. It's a great book. It gives a very different and fabulously fun exploration of what it is that drives humans to do what it is we do. It's a bit irreverent in places. It's exceedingly funny and completely intriguing. So Alchemy by Rory Sutherland would be my second one.
Brilliant. Chris, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll catch you soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Gareth.